Nostalgia, a word that had hitherto always meant homesickness, began to appear in its now prevalent sense, regretful or wistful yearning for the past, straight after the Great War. To Tolkien's generation, nostalgia was a constant companion. They were looking over their shoulders, like the survivors of Gondolin, at an old home that seemed now to embody everything beautiful and doomed. Tolkien's myth expresses the desire for such apparently timeless beauty, but constantly recognizes that it is indeed doomed. For all its apparent imperviousness, in the long run, the Lonely Isle, like Gondolin, must succumb to implacable change. So we're back again. Another special. Different special this time. Not part of the Gondolin thing. How you been?
Been good. How about yourself?
Pretty good. You're on your trip right now while I release this, most likely. We'll just assume it's been good. Or great.
Who knows? Great. Nothing less.
Do you want to introduce what we're doing today?
Sure. We will be talking a little bit about the story, The Cottage of Lost Play, which is basically the introduction to the Book of Lost Tales, which Patrick will give us some more background on. But basically, this is it's a collection of stories from Tolkien's notes that his son released, correct?
Yes.
So, yeah, it's basically, I would consider it like backstory to the world building. It's part of the world that Tolkien has created, but it doesn't fit perfectly into the Silmarillion or the more organized segments of the Middle-earth backstory, right?
Yeah, all right. How about I jump in now? Okay, so we're doing like Clifford said, the introduction to the Lost Tales. So, first of all, let's relate it back to the Gondolin thing we just did. That Fall of Gondolin story, like the detailed like battle scenes that we were all reading... That's one of the Lost Tales. And so if you remember from that, we said that was the original first draft story of like the Fall of Gondolin, which is a big Silmarillion story if you haven't figured that, or if we haven't made that clear already. But yeah, so that was written in like 1917. So like all the Lost Tales were written like late 19-teens, early 1920s. And this was the first time he put all of his mythology down to paper, like pen to paper on that. And so it's basically the earliest form of the Silmarillion is what you can kind of think. You know, and this, it's set out, like, we'll discuss the story here, but it's kind of told in, like, it's told in the way that, like, the wanderer, some wandering man shows up on an island of elves, and the elves go back and explain all the stories of the Silmarillion to, or that are in the Silmarillion to him. And and that comprises the Lost Tales. Now, we'll talk about why it's called Lost Tales after we get through the main story for the thing. But anyways, the Book of Lost Tales was, he eventually just abandoned writing it because, and it was in such a messy state that he couldn't even think about publication at that point because it was just way too jumbled, didn't make any sense at all.
So he started out with the intention of publishing it, maybe, and then it was never really organized enough.
Well, he had already been publishing poems at that point. You know, publishing stuff just for money purposes, really. You know, it's not like, it's not like, it was still like his private hobby that, and he kind of knew, like, yeah, probably nobody's really interested in this. I mean, his wife liked it, though. That's nice. Good support there. But then from this, eventually he starts developing, he's like, all right, this Lost Tales format, basically it's just not going to work out. But I like all the stories. And so then from there, he starts actually writing like Silmarillion kind of proper, even though, we can talk about it later, but like Silmarillion proper is probably like a bad term because it really never was anything. But compared to like the published Silmarillion that hardcore Tolkien fans know, is what I'm saying here. Yeah. Right. So anyways, we're going to tell the story of the intro story, mostly just because I think it's really cool. Like, I like it. Because it's very random, because it's... I mean, we're going to quote, like, a decent bit of it here, too, so you get the feel of it. But, I mean, like, it's very random, because at this point, Middle Earth, and it wasn't even called Middle Earth, they were just called the Great Lands in the middle.
Right.
You know, they were... this is the most primitive state of the mythology, and so basically close to every element in the story is eventually abandoned. It's none of it, none of it's kept, which is I don't know. It's interesting, and like this is really the beginning of the evolution of everything. And then it was a cool story. So I think we're just going to jump into it, and then we'll talk about where he was trying to go with it afterwards, and maybe that'll relate to set up for Lord of the Rings, which is still on the horizon.
Very cool.
All right. So go to the first page of the story.
Okay.
All right. So basically, there's a man. It's just a man. He's sailing in a ship, and then he lands. He sails west across the sea. So that would imply he's coming from Middle Earth, basically, for us. Okay. And he lands at this island called Tol Esara, which is the Lonely Isle. And so basically, even in the Silmarillion, if you read the Silmarillion, you'd be familiar with this. It's the island that's... It's like an island right off the coast of Valinor. I guess if we're using Clifford's analogy, though I'm going to destroy that later in this episode. If we're using Clifford's analogy, imagine, like, Japan off the coast of Asia.
Okay. Right? That's what it's like. So it's right there.
Yeah. Okay. You want to read that whole paragraph?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now one day, after much journeying, he came, as the lights of evening were being kindled in many a window, to the feet of a hill in a broad and woody plain. He was now near the center of this great island, and for many days had wandered into its roads, stopping each night at what dwelling of folk he might chance upon, were it hamlet or good town, about the hour of eve at the kindling of candles. Now at that time, the desire of new sights is least, even in one whose heart is that of a explorer. And then, even such a son of Arendelle as was this wayfarer, turns his thoughts rather to supper and to rest and the telling of tales before the time of bed and sleep is come.
So, should we take a couple things there? Well,
sure.
How about you prompt? You got anything to talk about there? I got a couple things.
I guess it's a... We're getting a little bit of the mood right here, in the sense that this guy is some sort of a wayward individual or traveler who enjoys the road, doesn't mind being alone, but of course even the traveler who needs no comfort still thinks of a fire and dinner and a warm home every now and then.
Right. Yeah, he's clearly an explorer, but
That said, it's all very vague. There's a lot of like non-specific details here, which I guess right off the bat was something that struck me about this story. Like, we've talked a bit before about the tone of The Hobbit and how it differs from the tone of the Silmarillion and how it will differ from Lord of the Rings, in that, you know, The Hobbit and Lord of the Rings are a bit of a more modern tone that we're more used to. The Silmarillion has the tone of, say, like Anglo-Saxon or Germanic mythology, where it's very detail-oriented and very descriptive, but doesn't feel very personal. And this is like a different tone entirely, I thought, as what, you know, you might hear as we read more, but it takes on almost like a dreamlike state, because it's not super specific about a lot of things.
Yeah, that's what I like. Obviously that's what I like about it. It's and maybe that's because he hasn't fleshed out his whole mythology yet. Or is it just, you know, this is kind of just what he likes, and this is like the mood that he's going for? But either way, it's stuff like that. That's why we're doing this. A couple of things I wanted to say just was, all right, so he's walking in the middle of the island just for plot purposes. That's that was like most of the paragraph. And then he's tired, so he's spending the night wherever he can find
one little tidbit. I was, when I read that, the lonely isle, I was like, Lonely Isle, what? Oh, the Lonely Mountain? No, wait. I was like, what do I know that from? Not from The Hobbit. It's from Saturn.
Yeah.
Anyways.
All right. So hamlets. Should we talk about what a hamlet is off the cuff? Do you know what Hamlet is?
Small town.
Yeah, it's like a sprue. Yeah. Does America even have Hamlets? I feel like we don't.
I think the term gets used a little bit. It definitely is not the same as a Hamlet in England or something.
Or like in Braveheart, yeah. Like William Wallace. Like he was from it. His little town there was a Hamlet where he started his rebellion.
Okay.
So that's kind of what we're talking about. But then they like grow and they could become modern. So they're still around in like England and even France, I think.
Right. I mean, it's basically just a small town, right? Starts out as a little farming village.
Yeah, but is it like... See, but like back then they were like super small towns. But then I feel like right. they've stayed around for hundreds of years to now there's like just a bunch of small towns everywhere. And they're uh-huh. like... They're still small, but they're big enough for like France... That they're big enough that they can host like a Tour de France finish, you know. Whereas there's mm-hmm, not a lot mm-hmm. of small towns in America that can host a Tour de France finish. I guess it's becoming irrelevant because most people don't know the size of the towns that host those finishes. And I guess I don't either mm-hmm. really. But
to get a little proper here, the word has many general meanings of small town or small settlement nowadays. In British geography, though. It is smaller than a village, and it distinctly does not have a church. Whereas a village might be unified around a single church, a hamlet is basically houses.
Excellent, Clifford. That was a good job. It's interesting. All right, so yeah, so they're like the outlying things around a village. So maybe they're mm-hmm. like that's where mm-hmm. like a couple farmers live, and then one guy maybe gets right. all the farms right. together and brings their food to the village or something.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Interesting. And then also. We got a name drop of somebody that we've heard of before in this paragraph. Did you notice it?
Yes, Arendelle. Yeah,
the man. Actually, the kid, based on what we know. Right, where's he from?
Yes, we remember that from the last story. That's Turin's son. Tur's son. Yeah. Not Turin. So he's the little kid who escaped with his parents from Gondolin at the end of our last episode.
Yeah, so to kind of understand this reference... But then again, they're going to make it again. To understand this reference, you kind of got to know something about what Arendelle grows up to do. And he becomes mm-hmm. the greatest mariner of all time. And a mariner is what?
Okay.
Besides a baseball team?
A sailor?
Sea voyager, yeah.
Okay.
So when they say he's a son of Arendelle, that doesn't mean literal son of him. That just means like he's... What's the word? Kind of
not
really descendant, but like a follower. Not even a follower, but like somebody that follows after, kind of follows in the same path or way as Arendelle. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes, I would say
takes after kind
of a like mind or something
and deeds.
Like that.
Yeah, mind and deeds. You know, going exploring mm-hmm. across the sea.
Right, so I inferred from context clues basically that such a son of Arendelle as was this wayfarer suggests that like even such an epic great wanderer traveler like Arendelle, this guy still has to think about dinner.
Yeah. All right, and so now they're telling us the man's name is how are you going to pronounce that? Ariel. Ariel?
Ariel? The text tastes weird. I would pronounce that... Yeah, I guess I just said Ariel. Ariel.
Yeah, but it's not like the mermaid.
Not Ariel. Ariel.
Ariel. Ariel.
Okay.
Ariel...
Okay.
I just said
Ariel.
I think I shortened it to just Errol.
Errol,
I don't know
that
if that's
works.
Right at all. Okay, whatever. Okay, so anyways, his name is what are we saying? What's his name?
Ariel.
Yeah, Ariel.
Yeah.
Not to be confused with any mermaids. Because this guy's name means he's a son of Arendelle. And second of all, his name means one who dreams alone. That's cool.
Okay.
Cool. Again, like just like all these cool details. So I think
sort of melancholy though, right?
What's up?
Sort of melancholy.
Yeah, the alone part, but like just like he's dreaming and like going off on all these adventures and like living mm-hmm. out his dreams. That's sweet. All right. How about you read that the bottom paragraph is
now is he at the summit of the hill amidst its houses, and stepping As if by chance, he turned aside down a winding lane, till, a little down the western slope of the hill, his eye was arrested by a tiny dwelling, whose many small windows were curtained snugly, yet only so that a most warm and delicious light, as of heart's content within, looked forth. Then his heart yearned for kind company, and the desire for wayfaring died in him. And impelled by a great longing, he turned aside at this cottage door, and knocking, asked one who came and opened what might be the name of this house, and who dwelt therein. And it was said to him that this was Mar Vanwa Tialieva, or the Cottage of Lost Play. And at that name he wondered greatly. There dwelt within, 'twas said, Lindo and Ver, who had built it many years ago, and with them were no few of their folk, and friends and children. And at this he wondered more than ever before, seeing the size of the cottage. But he that opened to him, perceiving his mind, said, Small is the dwelling, but smaller still are they that dwell here, for all who enter must be very small indeed, or of their own good wish become as very little folk, even as they stand upon the threshold.
Well, so that was cool. So that's the description. Mm-hmm. So Cottage Lost Play, that's all right, so that's where he's going. That's the name of the story, basically. Mm-hmm. Pretty cool description. I like that a lot. I like the delicious light as heart's content within. Like,
right.
It seems like a place I'd want to settle down for the night if I was passing through, you know?
Agreed.
What else? It was cool. What did I write down? That was cool. Yeah. It sounds like lots of people living there. You must be small to enter. So it seems like there might be either the people are physically small or there's going to be some magic or something. I kind of
got the impression that there's like some magic, like you shrink when you come in type thing.
Well, all right. So if we just move on a little bit, it says, he asks if he could be small enough to enter, and then he's allowed to. And then once he enters in, the house opens up, and it's very spacious. So maybe he shrank as he entered, or, like, it's just the magic of the
place. There's some magic there.
That, like, makes it big.
Or do you think it could be sort of like a, is it a humble thing? Like, small as in you have to be humble to come in, and when he's asking to be small, it's like, can I demonstrate my humility? Something like that? And that might be stretching it a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, that could easily be a possibility, I think. You know, okay. All right, okay. So I feel like we should actually just leave this for the end. But, I mean, at this point, if we want to put it in perspective, Tolkien's in, like, his mid-20s when he's writing this, so he's, like, our age.
And right.
So it's like, do you think you could ever write something like this?
I mean, I don't know if I could naturally, like, write anything with the sentence structure like this sort of old-fashioned flowery complex
language.
Let's
save it for the end, but I'm talking more like details, like fun, cool.
Okay.
Like the sense of this, but let's keep going with the story here. Mm-hmm, all mm-hmm. right, how about, so Lindo, you know, Clifford read Lindo, and you're saying it's Vyar? I say Vyari.
Ver?
No, it's got to be I. A-I. A-I is I. Vyar.
Okay.
Let's go Vyar.
Okay.
All right. Vyar. So whatever. The two people that own it, Lindo and Vyar, they greet him and everything, and then they go to one of these halls. You want to read the paragraph? And when Vyar had spoken the words of welcome, you want to read that paragraph?
And when Vyar had spoken the words of welcome, and Lindo had asked of him his name and whence he came and whither he might be seeking. And he had named himself the Stranger, and said that he came from the great lands, and that he was seeking whitherso his desire for travel led him. Then was the evening meal set out in the great hall, and Ariel bidden thereto. Now in this hall, despite the summer tide, were three great fires, one at the far end, and one on either side of the table. And save for their light, as Ariel entered, all was in warm gloom. But at that moment many folk came in bearing candles of all sizes and many shapes, in sticks of strange pattern. Many were of carven wood, and others of beaten metal, and these were set at hazard along the center table, and upon those at the sides.
Yeah, I like that description too. I like all the descriptions. See, alright, so we're going to get into this heavy, big time in Lord of the Rings, but like, Tolkien's just... he's just the man at setting like descriptions of places. Like, place descriptions are his thing. It's pretty sweet. Mm-hmm. All right. Oh, sorry. Okay. In my notes, I said, you want to read the next paragraph too? That one's, I also like that one.
At the same moment, a great gong sounded far off in the house with a sweet noise, and a sound followed as of the laughter of many voices mingled with a great pattering of feet. Then Vire said to Ariel, seeing his face filled with the happy wonderment, "That is the voice of Tombo, the gong of the children, which stands outside the hall of play regained, and it rings once to summon them to this hall at the times for eating and drinking, and three times to summon them to the room of the log fire for the telling of tales." And added Lindo, "If at his ringing once there be laughter in the corridors and a sound of feet, then do the walls shake with mirth and stamping at the three strokes in an evening. And the sounding of the three strokes is the happiest moment in the day of Little Heart the Gong Warden, as he himself declares who has known happiness enough of old. And ancient indeed is he beyond count in spite of his merriness of soul. He sailed in Wingolot with Arendelle in that last voyage wherein they sought for Kor. It was the ringing of this gong on the shadowy seas that awoke the sleeper in the Tower of Pearl that stands far out to the west in Twilight Isles."
Oh, another good description there, right? That was
Yeah, that was a lot. That was, I mean, I'm a little bit lost, I will admit. This is the head of the house, who is an elf, right?
Yeah, they're all elves there, yeah.
Talking to Ariel, who's a man.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Saying, there's the children, who I would have to imagine are also elves. Are they actually the children of Lindo and Vire?
Who knows at this point? I'm confused too.
Okay. Like... children, either literal or metaphorical, who live in this house. And then among them, some, specifically the gong ringer, has some, he's very ancient and has a connection to Arendelle, who is half man, half elf, we learned from the last story.
Correct. I don't know if we talked Arendelle. About that much, but yeah.
Okay, we'll get into that later.
Yeah.
Arendelle the Mariner,
mm-hmm.
and this gong ringer in the house sailed with Arendelle on the seas, somewhere near this isle, I would assume, and there's Kor, which I don't, it's some island, I guess, that they were looking for.
That's actually a city. Yeah, we don't
okay,
know that.
Okay, it's a city, and then we've got this sleeper in the Tower of Pearl. And then there's the Twilight Isles. So, a bunch of geography that I don't totally understand, but going back to what I was saying earlier, these general descriptions, like the shadowy seas, the sleeper in the Tower of Pearl, the Twilight Isles, are all like, yeah, they have a dreamlike quality for me, because it's like geography that I can't possibly understand, but then I could guess at very easily.
Right, or like when Ariel's being like, just calling himself the stranger, like not even...
Yeah, know, exactly. Yeah.
It's very vague.
It's like you're witnessing a story like from afar, like everything's kind of fuzzy, so you both are totally lost and fully understand what's going on at the same time.
Yeah, this just feels like, you know, you want to read this story on like a summer evening, like out in like a cottage somewhere. You know? Mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. But yeah, and then... The hints about what Arendelle does there, that's like the kind of like the original germ of what he would go on to do in the Silmarillion. I'll just say that.
Mm-hmm.
That's all we got to talk about there. Though, all right, and so then it's been a while since I completely read cover to cover Lost Tales 1 and 2, but I'm pretty sure this Little Heart guy, I'm going to guess he's either, you remember Vronwy from the last special, he was the guy that traveled with Tour to Gondolin.
Right. He was the one who washed up on the shore, yeah. And was a guide.
It's either, he's either this Little Heart guy who rings the gong, or it's his son. I think it's more likely his son. I don't really remember, though.
Interesting. Yeah. Okay.
We'd have to reread both the books to figure that out.
Uh-huh.
I kind of forgot. Sorry, everybody. I all these descriptions, they're sweet, you know. And then like all these different rooms, like there's the Hall of Play Regained. I really don't know what that means, or I forget what it means if I ever did know what it meant. And then the Room of the Log Fire for the Telling of Tales, that's sweet. See, mm-hmm. All right, Clifford, you know, you remember how like I've always told you, like, oh, Clifford, you'll design my house when I'm super rich, you know.
Uh-huh,
that's
uh-huh.
Gonna just be the key to the whole thing, is there will be a room with a log fire for tale telling. That's the number one thing
cool.
I want.
Cool.
It could be completely bare so long as we just got some log fireplace and then a nice cushiony chair. Well, we'll get into the cushions soon. All right, what's the next thing we got to talk about here? All right, lots of children eating, all sorts of different shapes and sizes. Yeah. So all these kids look different and everything. But they all, the one thing they share is they all have a look of great happiness lit with a merry expectation of further mirth and joy. That's kind of cool. Mirth and joy. Mm-hmm, all these descriptions, I love it. All right. So they sing the song of the bringing in of the meats, okay? And then and then Lindo blesses the food and the company. So based on what we know about elves, I guess just from The Hobbit, and then we didn't really mention too much from the, like, too much, like, in, like, practical, in-depth stuff with the elves and the Gondolin, but, like, it's kind of weird that elves have a blessing. Then again, this is early formation of this, so, like, you know, the standard protocol of Tolkien's elves is not yet established, you know, kind of. Like, he doesn't really know what elves are himself, really, I'd say. And then Errol asked where he is. So the next page. Okay. There's a long description and history of the geography of the island. Most of it's obscure and not useful for our purposes or even the future Silmarillion. Okay. Cool. if you can't say, I'm reading my own notes here. I got to remember what I said. Okay.
I will comment real quick on this on the geography description. Once again, I feel a little bit lost because I don't know these names. I don't really know where this is.
I feel lost too, though. If it makes you feel any better. Oh,
we are reading the Book of Lost Tales and the Cottage of Lost Play. So maybe being lost is the point.
No, we're going to talk about where these tales were lost from after we get the story.
But anyways, with the geography, some things that struck me just like trying to pick up what I could from the descriptions is we've got this land of elms or place of flowers.
Mm-hmm.
There's an island with some sort of citadel in the middle, which is like this phenomenal city with a great tower at the middle of the island, and everything feels like vaguely symmetrical, circular. The city is at the center of the island, which is at the center of the sea. And then in the city, there's the circular ring of trees. And like, it's all very, I guess from like an architectural standpoint, it's all very like proper. Like everything is exactly where it should be. It's basically epic. It's like a little bit absolute. This is not about like strange intricacies and things hidden in places. This is like the city on the island in the sea, you know?
Yeah, and what they were making it, so I guess it is kind of important for our purposes once we finish the story, but like the middle of the island, obviously, like he's basically gotten to the heart of the island. We established that at the beginning, but this land of elms is the fairest part of the island as well. Like that's going to be kind of important to note. And then he's kind of near a city near Cor Tirion. So there was Cor, which is where like they made the illusion that Rendil sailed to, and then there's Cor Tirion, which is on this island apparently in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So what were you saying? So what were you saying again? Like it's all like architecture in the middle, perfect.
Yeah, not necessarily perfect, but like the way that everything feels concentric, like it's all sort of lined up, and
yeah,
I don't have a good way to describe it, but. You get this kind of perception like in a lot of mythology or like older stories and even older architecture, it's like things are built on the point of a mountain or in the center of a valley, like it is in the most extreme version of the plate of its location description.
Yeah,
if that makes sense. Whereas like in more, we tend to think of like modern versions of that as being a lot more nuanced and like, you know, a location is tucked into the side of a valley or like it's less like epic basically. And this feels super primitive in terms of the city is in the middle of the island, which is kind of a circle, and the trees are in the middle of the city, and the city is also on a hill, and there's a tower in the middle of the city that's on top of the hill, so it's the highest point, etc.
Well, all right. Well, just to throw a wrench in that, he's at the cottage that was kind of off to the side of the main city that was in the middle.
Fair, fair. But I mean, it's like it just lends like this air of importance and mysticism, or like something is very important about this city, basically.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It is not taken lightly that the city has the tower in the middle on top of the mountain on the island, surrounded by trees. Like, that means it's very important, basically.
All right. So at the end of this, we're going to talk about what Tolkien thought the city was.
Okay. So, okay. Cool.
Foreshadowing to a score of minutes from now. Maybe. I don't know. All right, whatever it is. Okay. All right. So then there's an interesting part where the elves, so they're all sitting down to dinner, and the elves drink something called Limpi.
Okay.
Yeah. And so it says it helps them I can't really understand. It either helps them be youthful or they feel youthful. Which is, and then if they're all kids, it's like, are they elf kids? Or are these kids, like, you know, who knows? Like, are they, like, are the kids really old, but then they just look like kids? Or do they act like kids? Or I don't know. And then Ale needs permission from higher-ups somewhere on the island to drink it. Like, because only elves can, I guess.
Yeah, and there's this little detail. Thorinki only may give it to those not of the elder race, and those that drink must dwell always with the elder of the island until such time as they fare forth to find the lost families of the kindred. Which is kind of puzzling, but I take that to mean it's like, it's a little bit like what we remember from Gondolin, like, you know, the city is sort of magical, you can come here, but you can't leave. You know, like, maybe this drink gives you some sort of power, immortality type thing, but you have to stay with us.
Yeah, so I saw that connection, too. Like, that's what I thought of immediately, too. But, I mean, like, Gondolin was more, like, just security, safety, strategic.
Yeah, yeah, certainly.
Whereas this is, like, this might be, like, the magical source of elves, even. You know, like, who knows? Like, maybe they're not, you know, immortal unless they drink this stuff. In his original 1917 conception of this.
Right. But it's some sort of life force.
Okay, how about...
I feel like.
All right. Next section to read here.
Then sounded the gong of the children thrice, and a glad clamor arose in the hall, and some swung back big oaken doors at the hall's end, at that end which had no hearth. Then many seized those candles that were set in tall wooden sticks and held them aloft, while others laughed and chattered. But all made a lane midmost of the company, down which went Lindo and Vire and Ariel. And as they passed the doors, the throng followed them. Ariel saw now that they were in a short, broad corridor, whose walls halfway up were arrased, and on those tapestries were many stories pictured whereof he knew not, at that time, the purport. Above the tapestries, it seemed, there were paintings, but he could not see for gloom, for the candle-bearers were behind, and before him the only light came from an open door, through which poured a red glow as of a big fire. That, said Vire, is the tail fire blazing in the room of logs. There it does burn all through the year, for 'tis a magic fire, and greatly aids the teller in his tale. But thither we go now. And Ariel said that seemed better to him than aught else.
Oh, see, this is the room. Whatever. Well, so I said, like, when I'm rich and Clifford's going to build me a house, I don't think I'll ever be rich. But but this room, like, that's what it's all about. Oh, I love that.
Magic fire.
The fire enhances the tale telling. That's really cool.
Yes. And it's also, I like this, the room of logs, not the room of log fire, but the room of logs.
And also, like, even like a... a fire on a summer night, you know, not quite maybe like a bonfire where your coat's gonna smell like bonfire for a week, but but like, yeah, that's sweet, you know. And then it's all dark, but then there's like, you know, there's the tapestries up, and then there's paintings there too. This is the stuff right here. I don't know. I feel like I'm doing a bad job trying to describe why I like it so much, but I don't know. Maybe just reading the passages will justify itself. And then, okay, so anyways, I'll sit down to hear Lindo tell a tale. Okay, then Lindo's the guy that owns the house. He's the father, kind of. I guess they're saying he's
right, his kids. Right.
Yeah. Okay, so they keep identifying Ariel with, or Ariel, how do we say it again? Ariel with Arendil, which means he's just like a man of the sea. So it's like, you know, he takes after, he's got like the heart of Arendil almost. Like maybe that's the best way to say it. When, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Anyways, though, second paragraph, Ariel's quote, tell a story. So he wants to hear a story of the island in this house in particular. Okay, so we got a long quote coming up here. If we don't have a long quote coming up here, that means I cut it out because it was too much. Yeah.
Then said Fire, know then that aforetime, in the days of Inwe, and farther back it is hard to go in the history of the Eldar, there was a place of fair gardens in Valinor beside a silver sea. Now this place was near the confines of the realm, but not far from Kor. Yet by reason of its distance from the sun tree Lindolos, there was a light there as of summer evening, save only when the silver lamps were kindled on the hill at dusk, and then little lights of white would dance and quiver on the paths, chasing black shadow dapples under the trees. This was a time of joy to the children, for it was mostly at this hour that a new comrade would come down the lane called Olore Male, or the Path of Dreams. It has been said to me, though the truth I know not, that that lane ran by devious routes to the homes of men, but that we may never trod when we fared thither ourselves. It was a lane of deep banks and great overhanging hedges, beyond which stood many tall trees, therein a perpetual whisper seemed to live, but not seldom great glowworms crept about its grassy borders.
Hmm.
Now in this place of let's take that to start with. So this is Fire telling the story, and sometime in the distant past, like a time before time almost, or at the beginning of history, because they don't know
or the much beginning beyond. Of the elves, I think, yeah.
Right. The beginning of the elves' history. They're in Valinor, there's these gardens, and it's not far from this Kor city we've heard about before. There's light from a tree, which sounds like we've heard at least some version of that from the Silmarillion before in Patrick's description.
Yeah, the two trees.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then
also let me just say too. So Kor, if you're all right, just to like spoil a little bit because this isn't real. If you read the Silmarillion, Kor is like Tirion, like the elf city in Valinor. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we can go off that. And then Inwe is the forerunner of Igwe the elf. Mm-hmm. If you read the Silmarillion as well. Okay. Other than that, I have no idea what's going on. Like, what do you think this Path of Dreams thing is? I don't know.
Well, okay. Unclear what it means. The children are happy. The children I take to be the first generation, or like the young elves, kind of. Young in the world, even if they're not young in age. And then there's the Path of Dreams. The elves are sort of a dreamy race in general. Like, they walk around and dream. So maybe that's just, like, path of happiness type thing. Or path of goodness. But then it runs to the homes of men.
Right.
But then they haven't gone there themselves, etc., etc. And then the physical description of it sounds like something that I feel like I've only seen versions of in Britain or Ireland or Scotland or something. Like, I'm thinking rough, dark stone walls where you're walking through, like, it feels like you're sunken into the ground because the walls on either side are overgrown, and it feels like you're kind of winding through some sort of passageway, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. And I really, honestly, like, all right, this might be a cop-out, especially since we're, like, analyzing the story, but I honestly don't like analyzing it that much. Like, I kind of like this story just to keep it as, like, remote, very remote and just dreamy-like, you know, and just read through it just for, like, the pleasure of hearing the descriptions, you know?
Certainly. But,
so maybe, I don't know, maybe we won't do all of it. Why don't we do maybe another paragraph or two? I mean, it goes on for, like, two more pages in my book.
Okay.
So, you know, if you're really into this, you can look up the PDF Book of Lost Tales Part 1. It's the first story there. Yeah, let's do a little bit more, though.
Now in this place of gardens, a high gate of latticework that shone golden in the dusk opened upon the Lane of Dreams, and from there led winding paths of high box to the fairest of all the gardens, and amidmost of the garden stood a white cottage. Of what it was built, nor when, nor no one knew, nor no one knows, nor now knows. But it was said to me that it shone with a pale light, as it was of pearl, and its roof was a thatch, but a thatch of gold. Now on one side of the cot stood a thicket of white lilac, on the other end a mighty yew, from whose shoots the children fashioned bows or clambered by his branches upon the roof. But in the lilacs every bird that ever sang sweetly gathered and sang. Now the walls of the cottage were bent with age, and its many small lattice windows were twisted into strange shapes. No one, 'tis said, dwelt in the cottage, which was, however, guarded secretly and jealously by the Eldar, so that no harm came nigh it, and that yet might the children playing therein in freedom know of no guardianship. This was the cottage of the children, or of the play of sleep, and not of lost play, as has wrongly been said in the song of among men. For no play was lost then, and here, alas, only and now is the cottage of lost play.
Okay.
Interesting. So this is like
a description of something that's kind of like where he's at right now in the cottage of lost play, but it's not the cottage of lost play.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But this is some sort of magical house in the magical garden, basically.
Yeah.
Everything's overgrown and sort of dreamy, and these stories are very old, so they're not very clear. But it also gives me the impression that it's like these tales. I kind of like the way you described it earlier, like the mythology is in its beginnings or something.
Yeah.
For Tolkien himself, but at the same time he's writing about the actual beginnings of the mythology. So that like twofold thing.
That was honestly like the whole purpose of the 12-part Histories of Middle Earth, like Christopher mm-hmm. Tolkien just editing his dad's notes going through it, because like
right.
this is a spoiler. We'll probably do like at least devote some time to actually go in depth with this, but like
mm-hmm.
Christopher Tolkien released the Silmarillion after his dad's death, like he finished up, like made it make sense and be coherent, but then after mm-hmm. that he's like, should I really have done that? Because maybe it was better that, like, you know, as I was growing up, the whole evolution, like the whole history was changing, like it was evolving, like becoming deeper and greater, you know, like because like mm-hmm. this is written before Christopher Tolkien was even born, like a couple years before he was born, but then he was hearing all these stories, and then like they would evolve and become more intricate, you know, and then
mm-hmm.
to the Silmarillion that we have, and then also the Lord of the Rings is completely based off the Silmarillion, so
mm-hmm.
but yeah mm-hmm. it's not just like there's the linear history of Lord of the Rings, like Silmarillion, like creation, Silmarillion, mm-hmm. Lord of the Rings, like mm-hmm. straight horizontal timeline, but it's kind of like it's a little bit vertical too, in that you know, the whole history itself evolved throughout Tolkien's lifetime, becoming more detailed mm-hmm. and intricate as it went, and this is the mm-hmm. first beginning, most primitive state of it.
Mm-hmm,
pretty
mm-hmm.
cool. I mean, we could keep going a little bit, but I feel like that would kind of just drag on time. If you're really interested in this, again, you can find the PDF pretty easily, Cottage of Lost Play, mm-hmm. or, you know, you could give your hard-earned money to a well-deserving book, Book of Lost Tales, it's a History of Middle Earth Part 1. I'm sure you mm-hmm. can get it on Amazon. Yeah. why don't we go then and like set out to try to figure out or establish like what was the point of Lost Tales and everything.
Before we
do that though, do you have like any kind of quick general questions about the thing, just general ones a little bit?
Well, we've already answered some of my broad ones. I was a little confused at first about elves versus men, their relationship, what relationship this had to the rest of the worlds we've talked about, but we've gone through a bit of that already, so I feel pretty good about my understanding okay. of it.
All right, well then let's dive into it here. So like, what was the point of the Lost Tales? Viewed in the context of 1916-17, the arrival of Ariel, one who dreams alone, in the Lonely Isle, the land of release, has an air of a soldier's anticipatory dream of a homecoming in which everything will turn out all right again. but he is escaping the current of his own time and entering the timelessness of Fairy. Similarly, for the soldier, time seemed to have moved on incalculably in the trenches, but fallen behind in England. The Lonely Isle, then, may be seen as a symbolic version of the England that had slipped away. Nostalgia, a word that had hitherto always meant homesickness, began to appear in its now prevalent sense, regretful or wistful yearning for the past, straight after the Great War. To Tolkien's generation, nostalgia was a constant companion. They were looking over their shoulders, like the survivors of Gondolin, at an old home that seemed now to embody everything beautiful and doomed. Tolkien's myth expresses the desire for such apparently timeless beauty, but constantly recognizes that it is indeed doomed. For all its apparent imperviousness, in the long run, the Lonely Isle, like Gondolin, must succumb to implacable change. So, now, this is what's also cool about these books is it goes, Christopher Tolkien will lay out whatever big chunk of actual writing is there, like, even if it's just, like, the first draft kind of thing of all, like, the notes. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then with these books, he'll give commentary on it, too, because it's kind of, it's usually pretty hard to just, you know, understand just straight off the drafts. So, mm-hmm. If you're reading the commentary, there's like a direct quote here. It says, he said, the primary intention of this work was to satisfy his desire for specifically and recognizably English literature of fairy. And I got this quote here with it, which is real quick. Yeah. It was from the early days grieved by the poverty of my own beloved country. It had no stories of its own, bound up with its tongue and soil. Not of the quality that I sought and found as an ingredient in the legends of other lands. There was Greek and Celtic and Romance, Germanic, Scandinavian, and Finnish, which greatly affected me, but nothing English, save impoverished chapbook stuff. So, what he's basically saying is, Tolkien was like, all right, you know, I hear all about this Greek mythology, and then, you know, that translates to Roman mythology and everything. And then even Celtic mythology in Ireland and Wales, they all have all this cool stuff there, too. And then there's all this Germanic mythology and the Norse mythology with all the gods and everything. And it's all tied to, like, their language and to the land itself and everything. And then what he's saying was even, like, the Finnish stuff affected him the most. But there was nothing mm-hmm. English, you know? Like, at best, maybe King Arthur, but even that is more just like British. It's not Anglo-Saxon, and it's like maybe it takes place in Britain, but it's not Anglo-Saxon or anything. There's nothing English of this sort. And so he was just like, mm-hmm. Well, why don't I go out, you know, I think it'd be fun to just create, or better term would be like reconstruct, or, you know, make a artificial English mythology here that I can go off of based on like this elves and literature and everything. So that's basically what he set out to do with the Lost Tales. And that's why we'd say they were lost, is because it's like they, you know, like this is like being rediscovered, basically. You know, that's the lost part of it. It's like, right. We had right. forgotten these things, but Tolkien's uncovering it, you know, in quotes, and uncovering, you know. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. All right. So then if you're reading through the notes here, it also says, so Errol, basically, Christopher Tolkien, like, just lays out, he's like, so Errol is supposed to have come from Northwest Europe, across the Atlantic, okay? So this is why, okay. So this is where Clifford's, you know, analogy that he's been putting forward for the past couple of episodes of America, and then, you know, America's Middle Earth, and then uh-huh. Asia's Valinor, uh-huh. falls apart, okay? Because Errol yeah. comes from Europe.
Okay, well, I just want to defend myself briefly and say, clearly Tolkien is pulling from European references more heavily than anywhere else. I thought that geographically, the description of the Silmarillion, particularly the land bridge that disappeared, lent itself very nicely to the description of Middle-earth and Beleriand and Valinor.
Well, but anyways, if we're getting real,
please continue, Patrick.
If we're getting real technical with it,
denigrating my insight.
If we're getting real technical with it, the Silmarillion or all of Middle-earth is Northern European geography, as opposed to, based on your analogy, maybe Northwestern United States is kind of close to it, like Washington, I guess the coast, maybe. But, you know, like when you go further, like the great mountains and the big deserts and everything, it's like that has no place in Middle Earth right now. Maybe if you go really far south, like okay. southern than even Lord of the Rings ever goes, maybe. But like that, that doesn't okay. have a yeah. All right, anyways, and like he'll even explicitly say like even Italy geography, you know, like Mediterranean stuff. It's like no, Middle Earth's not supposed to be like that. And we'll get into that at some other point. But anyways, all right. So Errol, he comes from Northwest Europe, and this is actually like Europe itself. All right, and so he sails across the Atlantic, and that's where he gets to this Lonely Isle, which is right off the continent of Valinor. Okay, so then he hears, so he's on this island, and he's like, it's not all at the Cottage of the Lost Play, but it's around that city of Cortirion. He hears all the Lost Tales, which is basically all the big, heavy-hitting stories of the Silmarillion that's to come that, like, Tolkien fans know. So he'll have heard all of those. But at the end of it, the story would continue to where Ariel is actually like involved in the story, which we're going to get into in a couple seconds here. Okay. So over the course of the Lost Tales, this idea was eventually abandoned with Ariel. Ariel, he gets renamed A. Elfwine, basically, okay, like, you know, like the AE thing. Okay. But he kind of disappears and there's no trace left of him in the Silmarillion. Personally, I kind of like the approach, like the storyteller thing, as opposed to just like the, you know, closed, like, no, like just outside narrator that the Silmarillion has,
right?
And I think it, personally, in my heart of hearts, I think Tolkien did too. It just, there was no way to make it work out logically or feasibly to like actually do the storyteller way. So that's probably why he abandoned it. So, anyways, all that's left after that is just obscure outlines of what the story was going to be at the end of the Lost Tales. And here's what the outlines were saying about this Ariel guy. So he would have called himself Wyfer, which in Old English means restless / wandering. But then
the stranger, sort of.
Well, that's closer to just like wanderer than stranger. I don't know. Yeah, stranger kind of works. You're right. Okay. And then his father would have been Eo, which in Old English means horse. Okay. And then he would have been killed by his brother Bjorn. This is not the guy that we know in The Hobbit. This is just, you know, like the old English thing, like the warrior / bear guy, you know?
Right.
All
right.
If you want to know more about the old English of that, go back to our Bjorn episode, chapter 7. Okay. So anyways, Eo and Bjorn are the sons of Hedin? Yeah. Who traces his lineage back to Woden. And Woden is who?
Can't remember.
Odin.
Oh, okay.
Odin is obviously the Norse god head guy.
Right.
Woden is where we get the name Wednesday. It's Woden's Day.
Woden is Odin. Just another name for Odin?
Yeah, it's just like you put a W in front of it. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah.
In, but not like outside of Tolkien's histories.
Yeah. That's not a Tolkien thing. Yeah, that's like just a real thing. Yeah. Okay. So again, he's trying to tie this into like actual other mythologies, I guess. You know?
Right.
Okay. All right.
So the origin of this project really is like a
Germanic Norse kind of tying it with,
but
kind of
like a damn. Where's our part? Like
right, correct. Yeah, yeah. He's like,
England is missing out.
Right. He's all about like actually reconstruction.
Wouldn't it be fun if I kind of playfully filled in the gaps?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Correct.
And yeah, filling in the gaps is like. Yeah, we'll get in here in a second.
Okay.
So the sea lion grips Wyfer, which is Ariel, and then and he's deemed a son of Erendil, which encompasses basically all sea voyagers. So Ariel has two sons, Hengest and Horsa. Remember them because we're going to come back to them in a few minutes. They avenge Eo, and they become great chieftains in Northwest Europe. Okay. Meanwhile, Ariel, like he's you know, he's a sea voyager, he's an explorer and everything. He goes and seeks the unknown isle Tol Esero, which is where he landed in the story that we just read. Okay?
Right.
All
right. Right.
So now the elves end up naming, when he gets there, when he gets to Tol Esero, these are all like the outline forms of the story that we read and like where it was going at the end. Okay? And the elves name him Angol. Okay? Based on his homelands. So his homelands have something to do with Angol, A-N-G-O-L, okay? So then
sounds a little bit like Anglo.
Yeah, correct. This refers to the native homeland of the English across the North Sea. It's the coastline that's in between like Denmark and the Netherlands, you know, where they touch.
Right.
That's where the Anglos came from. Right. So that is what he's referring to.
Okay.
And so Chris Tolkien explicitly says, Errol came to Tolosera from the great lands to the east of the North Sea. He belongs to the period preceding the Anglo-Saxon invasions of Britain. Okay? Mm-hmm. Now, there's a later iteration of the story where Aelfwine, who's Errol, becomes Aelfwine as the story evolves. And he's actually an Anglo-Saxon Englishman, but we're not dealing with that. And I'm confused. I don't know. I'm trying to, like, just make this kind of straightforward for our purposes here. All
right. Right, right.
So Errol wasn't English because at the end of the story, Tolosera actually becomes England itself. That's the crazy part. Okay?
Okay.
So we mentioned that Corterian city, which is where, like, Cottage of the Lost plays, like, right on the outskirts of it.
Right.
That becomes the English city of Warwick, which is right, if you look at it like a map, like you can Google search this right now, it's right in the middle of the island of Great Britain. Okay.
Okay.
And that is where Edith lived for like 3 years before the World War One started.
Edith is his wife?
Yeah, Edith is his wife, yes. Okay. Thanks for reminding. And yeah, so like the land of Elms is Warwickshire, so this is right in the middle of England and everything. Mm-hmm. So this is where he's like getting like, oh, it's such a magical place. And this is like, it's presumably centuries before Tolkien arrived or was born or whatever. But yeah, but like even like core and war are kind of etymologically related a little bit.
Right.
According to Tolkien's language, or even just kind of the sound a little bit. Core, war. Yeah. So eventually there's an interlude between the Lost Tales where Errol ends up going to this place called Tavrobel to hear some of the tales, and that's meant to be the Staffordshire. So Staffordshire, you know shires? We're going to get into shire. I guess we're going to have to actually cover this in depth.
Uh-huh. But
England's a bunch of shires. You know, like, it's all these places called, like, Yorkshire, and, you know, we say shire, but it's, like, Yorkshire, Warwickshire, there's Staffordshire, there's Oxfordshire. I mean, you know, look at a map.
Gloucestershire, Worcester.
Right. So look at a map of England, you can see all the shires that are there. So these are all, like, many regions of England, basically.
Right.
I think just region's the best word. So anyways, right. So this is the Staffordshire village of Great Heywood, which after they got married, Edith lived there in Great Heywood, which is a town there, because it was near Tolkien's army camp before he got shipped to France.
Right.
So again, he's just like, you know, he's pulling all these places, and it's like places that mean something to him around the time of this writing. And so then, in the original conception, you know, our bad guy Morgoth, Melkor.
Right, right.
All
right,
so eventually he's going to come back from, you know, he had been defeated at the end of the Silmarillion, and that would have been covered in all the Lost Tales. But in the original conception, he's going to come back somehow, and they're going to fight him. And then the island of Tolosera, which is where he had landed this whole story, remember that?
Yes.
It would actually be move back to where Great Britain is. And so then if you look at, you have to, so Christopher Tolkien, who's the writer / editor of all these Lost Tales, he goes in depth about, you know, like the sketches, like, because all this is just outline form, nothing was ever written in any sort of formal story. But he just makes like kind of an outline of what was supposed to happen at the end of the Lost Tales. So like after the fall of Gondolin, after Arendelle's whole story, because spoiler alert, he's a big character. Then it's like, right, then right. It gets back to like, what is Errol actually doing all this? And so this was the deal. So here's the outline of it. So the Eldar, which Eldar just means elves, if we haven't established that already. Sorry if we haven't. Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. So the Eldar have all built a bunch of towns in Tolosera, which we establish, and then Errol comes to those towns, okay? Then after a time, and greatly instructed in the ancient history of gods, elves, and men, Errol went to visit one of these elves in the village of Tavrobel, and there he wrote down what he had learned, and he was also at last allowed to drink the Limpi, which was that drink that gave all the elves the
right sort of
maybe magic. Yeah, maybe their power or something, who knows. Right. Okay, so then in Tolosera, Errol was wedded and had a son named Hiorunda. Okay, so he's already got the two sons, Hengest and Horsa, back in the Great Lands, but I think his wife died, if I remember from something else. And so then he gets married again and has this third kid, Heorinda. Heorinda.
Okay.
Now, according to one of the outlines, because, like, Christopher Tolkien, what I'm reading from here, is, like, a summation of, like, 10 outline ideas that Tolkien had going. And so, like, Christopher Tolkien's just trying to make the best of his dad's notes from 60 years ago of writing this story.
Right.
Okay. So, according to one of the outlines, Errol dies at Tavrobel, consumed by a longing for his homeland, basically.
Okay, okay.
But according to another one, he actually sees the battle with Melkor that's going to happen, which is called the Battle of the Heath of the Sky Roof. Sounds interesting. Okay. Anyways, the lost elves of the Great Lands. So, like, all the elves that came back from Middle Earth is what that would be referencing. Rose against the dominion of the servants of Melkor, and the untimely faring forth took place, which at which time Tolesra was drawn back across. So after that, Tolesra is drawn back east across the ocean, and so the island, you know, it was near. It was right off the western coast of the western continent, right? Tolesra?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. So you can either think like near North Carolina or like near Japan or something. All right. So that's taken back across the sea. So Tolesra was drawn east back across the ocean and anchored off the coast of the Great Lands. So it comes back towards Europe and is anchored right off the coast. So we remember Olmo.
Right, god of the sea.
Right, okay. So, like...
the waters.
Basically, in the Silmarillion, there's a part where, like, there's an original island that he brings that way. And the way he does it is, like, he pretends, like, Tolkien pretends, like, the island's floating. And Olmo kind of basically, like, either pushes it or carries it on his back or has, like, a whale pull it
for him
or something. And it pulls the island across, which, obviously, in real geology, that's not possible. Right. Obviously, the island's already rooted. But, you know, then they root it down later or whatever. But Olmo got a water... He's got two god, like half god, kind of Maiar people that serve under him, and one of them's name is Osi, and he's like specializes in like everything that goes on around like the shoreline and everything. So when the island's uprooted, he's really pissed because like, you know, there's cool like coral reefs probably growing on it or something.
Right,
like that. Like he's really upset, and so when they drag this island across the sea. East across the sea, he didn't want that to happen. So then there's like apparently there's supposed to be some sort of big battle between the gods where like Osi tries to bring it back again, and then Olmo's like, no, it's got to stay put. And so then it breaks in half, and so that's what comes of that is the Isle of Iverin, which kind of sounds like what word?
Ireland,
correct. So that's like Great Britain separating. You know, this is how detailed he's getting with like explaining this mythology here. Kind of cool. All right. So Tolesra was now in the geographical position of England. Then the Great Battle of Ross ended in the defeat of the elves who retreating hide in Tolesra. So I don't really know what the Battle of Ross is. I don't know if that was against men or just against Melkor's guy. Whatever. Evil men enter Tolesra, accompanied by orcs and other hostile beings. So orcs and men come into basically Tolesra, which is / Great Britain. Or just Britain. Yeah. Battle of the Heath / Sky Roof took place not far from Tavrobel. So right around, you know, the Warwick place or Great Heywood place, there's going to be this big battle, I guess, with Melkor's guys, is what it sounds like. All this, you know, like, I'm just trying to say, like, my best interpretation of all this, too. I don't, you know, I'm kind of confused as much as people listening to this. Okay. The elves fade and become invisible to the eyes of almost all men. Okay, so the elves start to fade away, like, literally turn invisible. Interesting. We'll probably return to that theme at some point in Lord of the Rings, I would guess. The sons of Errol, so you remember the sons of Errol, there's three of them, Hengest, Horsa, and Heorinda, conquered the island and it became England. Okay, that was they were not hostile to the elves, and from them the English have the true tradition of the fairies. So, you know, there's like a Celtic or a Welsh tradition of the fairies. But, you know, now Tolkien's saying, like, no, this is the true tradition of the fairies. Like, the English have it, you know, in this artificially constructed thing that I just made up, you know? All right. Cor Tirion, which we said is the equivalent of Warwick, becomes the ancient dwelling of the... or is the ancient dwelling of the fairies, came to be known in the English tongue as Warwick. Hengest dwelt there, while Horsa dwelt at Tarunthorn, which Tolkien's saying would be Oxford, and... Heorinda at Tavrobel, which is, like we said, Great Heywood. And so that's how it would settle out. So I don't really know who the Heorinda guy is, but the Hengest and Horsa having them as sons is really interesting because in real history, first of all, Hengest and Horsa, Hengest means stallion, Horsa just means horse. All right, but these were the names of men. And in real history, they're the legendary figures that bring the Anglo-Saxon migration over to Great Britain.
Which would be...
So that happened, so after, you know, like, so Rome's, like, dying out, like, the Rome's falling apart, you know, in the West.
Right.
So then, you know, there's the famous Anglo-Saxon invasion of it, because before it was just, like, Britain people living there, and they're, like, basically kind of Celtic, you know?
Right.
So then, well, actually, so what really was probably going on was there's the Anglo-Saxons, which are basically, like, a bunch of German tribes in... Well, like we said, modern day kind of Netherlands or Denmark. And they were just one of the frontier German tribes that were like attacking like the frontier, like the Rhineland frontier of the Roman Empire. So like Rome owned France, Germany was German barbarians. And you know, like all the barbarians keep rushing through. So like they were one of those groups that would attack them. But since they were close to the sea, they were probably already raiding England anyways.
Right.
And so then the Romans were really cool. They were super smart because, like, basically it got, like, by, like, 200 AD, like, the Romans were just like, okay, we got all these barbarians on our borders. What if we paid them to actually do, like, lots of the guarding for us? And so, like, so what...
Buy
lots, right. So, like, what lots of these English kings would do is, like, they would pay the Anglo-Saxons to... come over to England to defend them against the Scottish because the Romans never conquered Scotland.
Okay, gotcha. Right?
So, like, they would hire him as mercenaries basically to protect him because they were already raiding him. So it's like, well, what if we just paid you to guard us from other enemies, you know? So then you wouldn't have to raid us, plus then you're guarding us and we don't have to spare our own men. But as Rome was falling apart, the generals that were there in England kind of just became their own kings because, like, there was no central authority anymore because Rome was too far away. All right. And but then these Anglo-Saxon guys, these mercenaries that are answering to him, they're kind of just realizing, like, why are we answering to this guy? Why don't we just conquer him and be our own kings? You know?
Right.
And that's actually probably what they thought. If these Hengest and Horsa people were real and they're considered brothers in, like, real history, then they probably came and they were probably mercenaries under one of the kings. And then they decided, like, well, maybe let's betray the king, or maybe the king betrayed them. I don't know, you know, if we want to make them good guys or something. And so they lead a big migration of their people there. Now, I don't know, did one big migration actually take place? Possible. Tolkien probably would say, like, yeah, they were probably real people, but lots of historians would probably just think they're fictional, you know?
Okay.
And just say, like, they're just legendary, but, like, you know, there clearly was, like, from that area of England, you know, the Anglo area, the Anglo-Saxon area up in, like, the Dutch Denmark part, they probably people were definitely coming across, like, year by year in the thousands, like around the end of the Roman Empire, which would be like 450s ish AD. So yeah, so that's kind of what he was tying the Lost Tales to, though, is like this Errol guy was the ancestor of the basically the founder of the Anglo-Saxon kind of migration kingdoms, you know, because when they get there, Britain sets up like a bunch of different Anglo-Saxon kingdoms where like they're speaking the language of the German people where they're kind of from. I feel like we'll come back to them actually pretty shortly, I think. Hengest and Horsa, but that was like the original idea of the Lost Tales was. That was the goal of this. Kind of interesting. And then it's like...
Definitely.
And that one's really interesting because he tries to relate it to actual... Or, you know, basically actual history or mythological history. Real mythological history as opposed to this artificial thing that he's creating.
Right.
Pretty fun. Like that whole... You know, he's really obsessed with those areas where it's like just beyond written record history. You know?
Right.
Like the... How much of this was true or whatnot, and like, you know, he like thrives off that, you know, just beyond like the civilized region, which is really I highly enjoy that too myself. I like to think
it's an interesting thing, generally speaking, like where you draw the line between like a scholar historian character and like a creative poet type, and Tolkien seems to have elements of both, but it's like. I wouldn't be surprised if like a lot of history scholars would kind of draw a line and say, you know, like, because I'm not necessarily for the sake of being unbiased to the things they're studying, but like they're not necessarily in the business of imagining what might be, but instead figuring out what was. And then you could say that the poet character is instead much more concerned with what might have been or what could have been than with what specifically was. And Tolkien's kind of like straddling the two.
Yeah, Tolkien's more romantic in that way.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't say he's like, it's not like he's strictly unbiased, like he's like completely biased towards whatever he wants to think.
No, certainly not. No, definitely not. But I mean, it's like I guess I mean like not a lot of people take that leap from having like a fascination in an area of study and then launching like a sort of fantasy creative interest off of that. Like, let me fill in the gaps with my own invention.
Oh, well that part, yeah.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But, because even, like, some historians will say Hengest and Horsa were just legendary figures that never existed, and, like, they're just, like, you know, come down from some sort of ancient tradition or something. But Tolkien would probably be in the camp, like, well, these two are real, and then now I'm going to write, like, some fictional thing just as a personal hobby
right.
about them.
Right.
You know, that'll lead down to them mm-hmm. and connect to their tradition, mm-hmm. you know. So that's, like, poetic way beyond that
mm-hmm.
but even the claim that just like Hengest and Horsa were real, that's actually kind of controversial.
Yeah. Okay.
From what I was looking up,
uh-huh.
though I'd say I'm always in that camp too, like there's always like a kernel of truth to a real person.
Yeah,
whether it was as big, you know, same with Beowulf, like there's probably a Beowulf guy, right. You know, this is the culture that brings Beowulf to England, like Beowulf, yeah, just as a side note there. Strikingly, Tolkien wrote his first account of a mortal's arrival in Faerie, the cottage of Lost Play, just after his return to England from the Somme with trench fever. Ariel's first impressions of the Lonely Isle are much happier than those in Luni and the Sea Bell, but he glimpses Faerie's indifference to humanity. Tolkien's outlines show that the mariner would eventually become alienated from his kind, and in the last pages of the Book of Lost Tales, Ariel expresses his fear that his message to human posterity, the tales he has recorded, will be lost. Yeah, I'd forgotten to talk about this in my notes. So those were excerpts from John Garth's book, Tolkien and the Great War, again. We were quoting that a lot last week. That's kind of all I got for this. Oh, I guess the cottage itself, if you want to know anything more about the cottage, there was a couple love... Like, that was one of the first poems he wrote. It was like a love poem about him and Edith.
Okay.
If you want to look it up, look up You and Me and the Cottage of Lost Play. You could probably find it on the internet, I assume.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That was the original version, and then there's a couple more. There's like a second draft and a final draft, and the final draft is called The Little House of Lost Play, Mar Vanwa Talia Taya Livia.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. More about the cottage, though, yeah. I don't know. I feel like kind of wrapping it up here for this one.
Cool.
Yeah. I don't know. What'd you think?
Like I said, I was very intrigued. And it's a cool window into like an entirely different or partially different style from Tolkien and like a different part of his brain, basically.
Yeah.
So I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, and I like how it... See, I actually like that it connects a little bit to all the Silmarillion stuff and everything,
right.
But it really doesn't. And I like kind of like that. I kind of like it being just remote, mysterious, and dreamy, like what we were saying. He's got a couple other short stories that are unrelated to Lord of the Rings. Maybe we'll do like a special about those. But some of them, it's like... Or one in particular, I just don't even want to do a special because it's just like... I kind of like not knowing the whole like intricate details and point of the story. I kind of just like enjoying the story just for its own sake, you know?
Right.
And it's the same with this one.
Right.
Though we did kind of dive into it a little bit, but yeah, it's fun.
Cool. Well, I think that was, I think that's pretty good. I think we'll probably leave it here. After this, depending on whatever release so far, this is the probably the last big special thing before we jump into Lord of the Rings. So get ready for that. I am excited. That's been months in the making at this point.
I'm excited as well.
Yeah, it should be good. All right. Yeah. Continue to be safe on your trip, Clifford.
Thank you very much, Patrick.
Yeah. All right. Thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, y'all.